Once you've seen one, you can hardly wait for the next. Total eclipse.
People describe it as like being in a dream as the landscape takes on sort of hues and colors that you've never experienced.
In a minute, filmmaker Mike Day gets us ready to experience the great American solar eclipse.
Just take it all in. Just enjoy it for how alien it is.
The paddle pilgrim encounters the holy places of Cambodia on a kayaking trip down the Mekong River.
You have a wat, which is Buddhist, a bat, which is Hindu, and a stupa is a little personal shrine.
And Cecily Wong from Atlas Obscura cautions us about some of the world's strangest fermented foods, like the hallucinogenic honey you might find in Turkey.
There's a long history of using this honey for good and evil.
Stick around for the hour ahead. It's Travel with Rick Steves. Pretty much all of North America is expected to see a partial solar eclipse coming up on Monday, April 8th. But to experience the otherworldly total eclipse, a narrow zone extends from central Texas and Indiana to Lake Erie in the north country of New York State before it reaches Newfoundland. In just a moment, we'll hear why so many people are traveling in hopes of an otherworldly 2 or 3 minutes under a total eclipse. Also on today's Travel with Rick Steves, the paddle pilgrim returns to report on his kayaking adventure down the Mekong River in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. And Cecily Wong tells us about some of the world's most curious fermented foods. A total eclipse of the sun is about to darken parts of America on April 8th. It's like nothing else you've ever experienced, maybe. When you get a rare chance to be in the path of a total solar eclipse, you'll see and feel the moon's shadow sweep across the Earth. The landscape takes on an otherworldly hue as day quickly turns to night, and the sun's corona dances in a mesmerizing display. Wow. Mike Day has spent his career traveling to some of the world's most interesting places in his role as a producer of IMAX film documentaries. And 5 times he's witnessed a total eclipse, and that's made him want to see more. Mike joins us today from his home in Minneapolis to shed a little light on the magic and the science of these celestial spectacles. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a privilege to be here. Thank you, Rick. And on April 8th, for the total eclipse of the sun, I will be in Waco, Texas.
In Waco? Is that, you've calculated or somebody's calculated, that's a good place to camp out to wait for this to happen?
Well, we refer to this as the Great North American Eclipse, as the moon shadow comes ashore in Mexico, across the United States, up through the Northeast, and then out in Canada. And the weather prospects, long-term as we look at weather, are better if you are further south.
Ah.
And I've chosen Waco not only for the weather factor, but if you're going to be serious about, you know, chasing an eclipse, you may actually have to chase. The answer to the question of where is the best place to see an eclipse is quite simple: where the sun is shining. So if you are in a place that weather is coming in, clouds or worse yet, rain, you want to be mobile. You want to be ready to move. So I am ready to hop in my car in the middle of the night and drive either south or north. You can stay on the interstate out of Waco, and you'll stay in or very close to the moon shadow path, but you do want to get to where you can actually see the eclipse. It's certainly worth that kind of effort.
So people actually jump in their car and drive an hour to be repositioned.
I can tell you that in 1979, I went to Manitoba. We were in Winnipeg for the February 26th eclipse. The weather forecast was not good for Winnipeg. We got up in the middle of the night. We drove west through Manitoba, and in the darkness, we started to see starlight, so we knew we were not under the clouds, and we did see that eclipse, all 2 minutes and 45 seconds of it.
So we know about storm chasers, and in fact, you documented them in a film you made about Tornado Alley, but you sound like an umbrophile.
I am. It's interesting. You mentioned that I had a career making documentary films, shooting in the world's largest film format, IMAX. So what do I do when I go to a total eclipse of the sun? I never take a picture. And that's not just my advice. That's the advice of a lot of people who've done it. don't waste your time getting distracted with cameras and telescopes. It is such an extraordinary experience and one that happens in just a matter of minutes. Just take it all in. Just enjoy it for how alien it is.
I go through that same little struggle every time I'm at a magic moment. You know, the running of the bulls. They're going to go by and it's going to take 10 seconds. Do I want to fiddle with my camera and get a good shot, or do I want to really be there? And it's a tough question. And you could probably see people over the years, as you've been to so many of these sites, where people are cursing their camera and fiddling and struggling, and other people are just in the moment.
It's always interesting because the veterans who've set up their telescopes with their proper filters and they're shooting on timing devices, after the eclipse, there'll always be one of those veterans who will say, oh, I forgot to take the filter off the front of the telescope when the total eclipse happened.
So now you're an umbrophile, and that means it's somebody who chases eclipse, right? Is that a culture? I mean, do umbrophiles have something special in common? Do you know when you sit down in a bar the night before an eclipse that this guy's like me, we're birds of a feather?
That's right. You become an eclipse junkie. And, you know, one of the great things about eclipses that I think you will appreciate is even if you go someplace and get weathered out, as I did one year when I went to Colombia, we took a bus over the Andes Mountains out onto the Llanos, stayed in a town called Agua Azul. The eclipse was going to happen late in the day. The storm clouds came in, so we didn't see the eclipse. But, you know, at the end of the trip, we said, hey, that was a great piece of travel. There's no other reason I would go to Agua Azul, Colombia.
You got to have that attitude. And I'm practical to a fault, I think. My son went to France for the Tour de France, and he parked himself up on this mountain road, and it was a great labor to get there. And then the bikes all go by, and that was it. And he loved it. He would do it again in a heartbeat. There's something more than that moment you traveled for, isn't there?
Well, the fact that I went to, you know, Winnipeg and then out into rural Manitoba in February of all times of years. Terrific. The Great American Eclipse of 2017. I went to Kearney, Nebraska. Same kind of experience. I would have had no other reason to go to Kearney, and it was wonderful. The people you met, food, it was just a great travel experience even beyond seeing the eclipse.
Hey, this is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're talking with Mike Day. Mike is a documentary film producer, and he spent his career traveling to some of the world's most interesting places. He spent a lot of time discovering that serendipity can happen anywhere, and he writes about it in his book, The World Has a Big Backyard, Adventure Travel Stories from an IMAX Documentary Filmmaker. His website is MikeDayTravels.com. Hey, Mike, let's just say I'm a curious, reasonably smart 10-year-old. Can you explain to me in real simple terms what is going to happen?
Well, you know, the moon goes around the earth goes around the sun, the moon reaches its new phase between the earth and the sun every month. So the question is, why don't we have a total eclipse every month? Well, it's because the orbital plane of the moon around the earth is tilted just slightly to that of the earth around the sun. So we only have a total eclipse about every 18 months. And the moon shadow as it races across the surface of the Earth is generally, as it will be for this eclipse on April the 8th, it's only 120 miles wide. It's moving at a very fast rate. You'll only be in the shadow for 4 minutes. And it is amazing because when the moon covers the sun, you have this black hole-like view in the sky. And now you're seeing the outer atmosphere of the sun, the solar corona. This is the only time you're going to be able to see it. The temperature is going to go down, and you're going to see a 360-degree sunset effect. We see how the skyline gets orange when the sun goes down in the west. Well, now you have that orange glow all the way around.
Oh.
But one of the most interesting things is, in the last 10 minutes before the moon totally covers the sun, you have this waning crescent of sunlight. It's a sunlight that you've never seen before, and people describe it as like being in a dream as the landscape takes on sort of hues and colors that you've never experienced. There's also a sharper vision that you have in these waning moments before totality. So I encourage people to really get out in the open, get away from buildings, and just bring along your camp chair, sit, and enjoy the experience. You know, people can describe it, show you pictures, show you movies, but it just doesn't convey the way it is, as I've heard it described. It overwhelms the senses and it overwhelms the soul.
Wow. You know, as you were talking about that, I was just recognizing the value of a good tour guide, frankly. And it reminded me when I was a student, it must have been in the maybe late 1970s, in Seattle, and I drove east of the mountains, east of the Cascades, because all of us wanted to go see this eclipse, a total eclipse. And I remember the sudden chill, and then I remember animals and birds kind of going crazy. And then, you know, there's like an eerie silence. But I didn't have any idea what was happening, and I didn't have anybody to explain it to me.
Yeah, and one of the things I advise people to do, you know, you can go online and you can watch videos that people have shot of eclipses, but look at the videos where people have just filmed the crowd and watched their reaction. Yeah. If you didn't know what they were looking at, you'd say, wow, I don't know what those people are looking at, but I want to see it. I want to be there. And you get a real sense in those waning minutes before it goes total to the eclipse of how excited people already are with this dramatic illumination change in the landscape. And then, of course, the crowd goes crazy when totality hits. And people applaud at the end. They'll even be shouting, encore, encore, after those few minutes of totality.
Now, you write that the difference between a total and a partial eclipse is like the difference between making mad, passionate love and having your grandmother kiss you on the cheek. That's a pretty dramatic way to put that. There's a huge difference then between totality and even 99% totality, huh?
Is there absolutely.
It clicks in there.
You have to be in that shadow path, not just outside of it where you'll see 99% of the sun being covered. There's great websites, there's great almanacs that will show the path of the sun that you can go to see where you want to be.
Hey, Mike Day, thank you so much. You're going to be in Waco, Texas on April 8th. There's going to be a lot of people excited about this total eclipse of the sun. What is your last advice for those of us who are privileged enough and able to be there? What is your advice?
Well, again, make sure that you are mobile in case you have to move to get out of the way of clouds or a rainstorm. And even if you just are pulling off on the side of the road to be in that shadow, don't worry about anything else. There's no special place to be except where the sun is shining. So good luck to everyone on April 8th.
All right, Mike, this is eclipse number 6 for you?
This is number 6, and I've only been weathered out once before.
Well, that's a good average. Thanks so much, and maybe we can talk after you've had number 6. Thanks again.
Thank you, Rick.
We have web links to help you prepare to see the eclipse. Look at the notes for this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Our friends at Atlas Obscura profile some of the world's oddest food traditions in just a bit. But up next, a retired Lutheran pastor tells us about his latest kayaking excursion down the Mekong River through the heart of Southeast Asia. It's Travel with Rick Steves. It started out as a month-long kayak adventure on one of the longest rivers in Asia, but a surprise heat wave and drought forced them to slow down and linger with the lotus. And that actually gave Dave Ellingson and his travel mates time to take in the spectacular landscapes and make friends with the river angels they'd meet along the way, as well as witnessing the remains of war and genocide, to see today's environmental challenges up close, and to get in touch with the centuries-old spirituality at the region's temples and sacred sites. Dave Ellingson is a retired Lutheran pastor and professor, a master gardener, and a competitive runner. His Paddle Pilgrim book series describes the lessons and encounters from his earlier paddling adventures on the Mississippi and the Hudson Rivers and in the fjords of Norway. In his latest volume, Dave describes his adventure down the Mekong River in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Dave, welcome back.
Great to be here, Rick. Thanks for the invitation.
Wow, you know, I know you from, you're just a neighbor, and we've kayaked together, and we've been on the show several times talking about your adventures, and You are just such an inspiration, and I never know where your next adventure is going to come from. And this is across Southeast Asia. Tell us about how the trip came about, and it seems a little different from some of your other trips.
Well, I had paddled in the U.S. on the Mississippi River, the Headwaters, the Erie Canal, Hudson River, and then I went to Norway, which is my ancestral home, and paddled the fjords. But it was all in Western culture.
Yeah.
I wanted to experience Asia. And as I thought of this journey, this Mekong River flows through seven countries. And so the cultural, spiritual, political history of this area is just amazing.
It's a lot. It's, well, a different world than what you'd have in the United States with the Mississippi, or you went to the fjords of Norway, and that was sort of your heritage and so on. And this is quite an adventure. Now, you do compare the Mekong with the mighty, you call it the muddy Mississippi and the mighty Mekong. Each of them is about 2,000 miles long.
Mississippi, a little more than that, 2,500.
You know, they each serve a lot of territory, a bunch of states or a bunch of countries. Both are dealing with climate change and seasonal impacts for a kayaker. But talk a little bit, because we all know the Mississippi. Relate that to the Mekong.
Well, the Mekong, like the Mississippi, is the lifeblood of Southeast Asia. It affects every country, and its fate impacts the lives of people, whether they're fishing in the river, whether they're just traveling on the river. It's their highway. It's their business. It's their source of income, and it's really a part of their very nature. The river is their place and their waterway, their symbol of life.
You did the trip when? March 2023.
Yes.
And tell us about the actual itinerary. Where did you start? Where did you finish? How long was the trip?
Well, given the length of time we had, which was a little over a month, we realized we could only paddle a certain distance. And so we chose the Paxi is the city in Lao.
Uh-huh.
And we flew to Ho Chi Minh City, went to Paxi, began paddling there, and paddled over a little bit of Laos, a good bit of Cambodia, and really all of the Mekong Delta.
Hmm. And then it dumps into the sea, just like the Mississippi does.
Yes, it dumps into the North China Sea, which is a bone of contention for all Vietnamese because it runs all the way along their super long country that goes way, way up to China.
Uh-huh.
And they feel it's the South China Sea or the Vietnam Sea. So there are arguments going on right now between those two countries. And
it's a complicated political world.
Oh, the geopolitics are at the heart of many of the issues today.
But when you're in a kayak, I mean, I've been in a kayak with you. You're little. You know, you have to reach up to pick the blackberries.
Yeah,
You're just way down close to the water. What is the view from the kayak of the cultures that you saw?
Well, that's what I love about kayaking. You're close to the water. You're close to the people. So little boats. Many of the boats are just little boats piloted by local citizens, and they're out fishing or they're doing their daily travel. And so you paddle right by them or often stop and just greet them and say hello. And then we could paddle into shore where there's a village. We could paddle to a sandbar and put up our tents. We could stop in a village and actually pay the local citizens $5 and have a place to sleep on the floor and to get two meals.
My goodness. And there's a picture in your book of one of these floating markets.
Yes.
And all the boats there laden with vegetables and fruits and people's wares. The boats are about the size of your kayak. So you're sort of, you just slither in there.
Well, you do. But you do have to be careful because it's like the Mississippi in the regard that there's large barges, particularly hauling rice. And they don't stop for my little kayak. We have to look ahead and try to avoid them. And we had several close scrapes where they were just doing their business. And I would yell to the team, shoreline, shoreline, quick. And then they'd come roaring by and we'd sit in their wake.
So you talk about your team. How many
Yes.
of you were there and each had a kayak of their own?
Correct. I actually had a corporate sponsor. Advanced Elements Kayaks gave us four kayaks.
Uh-huh.
And my team included a retired defense attorney who travels all over the world in his third act. I had a high school classmate who's a professor, an environmental biology professor, in Florida.
Yeah.
And then the third person was very interesting. It was a fellow who was a product of the Vietnam War.
Huh.
He was adopted by an American family and went to a college in the Midwest and then felt a call to ministry, and he's a Lutheran pastor now.
So you're a retired Lutheran pastor, and so is he.
That's correct.
This is Tom, right?
Yes, that's right.
And then, but he had that connection with Vietnam.
He did, yeah. And he figured there were many thousands of mixed-race kids as a result of the war, and he thought his dad was probably a soldier.
Uh-huh.
Well, as it turned out, through DNA, he found out that his dad was a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist writing for the L.A. Times and had come from Yale. I was at Yale at the same time as him, Hillary, and Bill Clinton, a whole bunch of us back in the day, and he was sent to Vietnam on his first job.
Huh.
And he wrote about it, and he told the truth about the war, and he was kicked out.
Kicked out?
Of Vietnam.
And he left what would be?
Well, he didn't know he had a son until about 2-3 years ago, and Tom found him and has reached out to him, and they've become father and son across the country. Now, here's a funny thing Tom likes to say. He says, I found out, first of all, he was Jewish. And he said, and the family tradition and probably my mother, my biological mother, is probably Buddhist. So I'm probably the only Buddhist, Christian, Jewish pastor in the country.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that gives him another angle.
Indeed.
This is Travel with Rick Steves, and we're talking with Dave Ellingson. And we're talking about, the newest edition of his Paddle Pilgrim series. This book features his kayaking adventures on the Mekong River through Laos, through Cambodia, through Vietnam. And he's with us today to tell us what he learned on his latest voyage through one of the world's most biodiverse areas. Dave's website, if you want to learn more about his work or pick up his book, paddle-pilgrim.com. Dave, I got to mention, you are almost a decade older than me. I love talking to you because you remind me I've got a lot of travel ahead of me. But we've been doing these kind of reports on your kayaking adventures for a decade now. How's the body doing? You're 75.
Well, I've had a lot of parts replaced,
yeah.
You know, and I'm put girks into my knees so that they can lube my knees to make sure they work well. Both knees have been replaced. My wrist has been basically fixed. I've had almost every kind of surgery imaginable.
And you're squatting in this kayak, working, paddling hard for all day. It's 100 degrees out there in the water, and you do this for a month at a time.
Yes.
What's your trick?
Well, I have wonderful genetics. My family are a long-lived people. Secondly—
Well, tell us what's in your medicine cabinet.
Well, that is important, too. I'll tell you.
You wrote about a cocktail there.
Indeed. Well, I'll add one other thing. My doctoral work was in holistic health.
Okay.
So exercise, nutrition, stress management.
Yeah.
This was 50 years ago I wrote it. They said a bunch of hippie mumbo jumbo.
Right.
Now doctors—
People accept it.
Accept it because it's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
Dave, when you're doing something like this, what did you use for information? Is there a guidebook to help somebody kayaking down the Mekong River?
There are. Lonely Planet, which I was found very, very helpful, is a fairly formal guide, you know.
Right.
I read a book by Brian Ehler called The Last Days of the Mighty Mekong.
Ooh.
And he is the Southeast Asian resource person for the Stimson Institute, a think tank in Washington, D.C. He knew more about particularly the geopolitics, the environmental issues, and he connected me with a bunch of people in Vietnam who are our river angels.
But as a good traveler, you understood the importance of doing a little groundwork ahead of time, getting that information.
Absolutely.
Now, reading your book, it seems like I just thought the mechanics of doing this trip must have been so much fun. You were coming into Don Kong Island, and from the chapter, it just felt like, oh, you found a luxury resort, and it was $25 a night, and you thought, well, this is a splurge. Let's tie up our kayaks and treat ourselves well, splash out, you know?
Yeah.
Did you just stumble onto places? Because you can't really predict exactly where you're going to be, and when it comes time to call it good, you just tie up your kayak and look for a bed.
Plan A often doesn't work. And you never know what's around the next bend.
You can't make reservations for a trip like this, I wouldn't
think. And we saw this hotel, and we pulled in, tied up our kayaks, walked up a steep, steep slope, and here was a wonderful river angel who became our guide for 4 days.
So river angel is your term for these people that just, like, come out of the blue and help you out.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And they're everywhere. I mean, they were on the Mississippi. They were in Norway.
It's a reoccurring character in all of your books. But here, you're tying up in somewhere in the middle of, who knows, Cambodia or Vietnam, and you've got these fancy, you know, high-tech kayaks, and you just tie them up, and you walk up the hill, and you check into a hotel, and the next morning, your kayak's where you left it.
Yeah.
You didn't worry.
No. The kids were very curious. They wanted to see them, and the kids would come running down to the shore to wave to us. And quite often, we'd stop and let them sit in our kayaks.
Oh, yeah.
And then oftentimes, the people who would come down to see what their kids were up to would help us out with something.
But this is amazing. So many people would be so uptight, and they'd have all of their fancy security things, and all you did was make friends with the kids and go up and check into a hotel.
Well, and we were wondering, one of my questions, since it's 50 years since the Vietnam War, which affected my life enormously and many families, I wondered, well, what are these people thinking, whether it's in Laos or Cambodia? They were all, every single one, friendly, gracious, hospitable, welcoming.
In your book, you write like you're almost like the Pied Pipers, attracting all these children. The cool thing about your book is you're taking notes as you're paddling.
Yes.
And you wrote, prejudice and hate must be learned behaviors.
That's right.
Because these kids did not learn to be prejudiced and hateful.
No, they're curious. They're little scientists, as Jean Piaget, the French developmental theologian. They're trying stuff all the time. And if you're kind, my basic philosophy out of my faith, but I think it's true anthropologically, if we're kind to people, they will be kind.
You know, I've been thinking about that a lot lately, Dave, because I've got these travel as a political act talks that I give and so on. And I really say the takeaway is you come home with this appreciation when you have a good trip and you connect with people, real people, that the world, sure, it has its problems, but the world is basically filled with good people, with love, with joy, with families.
Absolutely.
And we just got to get to know them.
Absolutely. And as you say, travel is the best teacher. I say that the outdoor world is a classroom or a cathedral.
Yeah.
Because it leads not only to learning, but it leads to, I think, a kind of spiritual depth to realize that we're surrounded. In Vietnam, it's Hinduism, it's Buddhism, it's wonderful ancient wisdom. And I tried in both my book and the film I produced about this to honor those teachings. So if there was a temple nearby, we went in and prayed with the people. We lit a candle and we tried to absorb this spirituality, which really affects the lives of people there.
You know, that's what I really like about your books is your sort of witness. Your faith is one that honestly respects all these other religions and just it's a festival.
Yeah.
Everybody just trying to figure out God, you know.
That's right. Yeah.
Dave Ellingson's known as the Paddle Pilgrim for the number of long-distance kayaking adventures he's accomplished and the books he's written about them and the life lesson they revealed. He's with us today on Travel with Rick Steves to tell us about the month he and his travel buddies spent attempting to kayak down the Mekong River in Southeast Asia during a surprise March heat wave and drought. His book about it is the fifth in his Paddle Pilgrim series. Dave's earlier adventures were kayaking the Mississippi River from its Minnesota headwaters all the way to Louisiana, on the Erie Canal and the Hudson River from Buffalo to Manhattan, and kayaking in the fjords of Norway, where his ancestors lived. Dave, when we're talking about traveling by kayak down the Mekong River, I just couldn't help but think about all the wonderful food you had.
Oh,
and you wrote about it as street food and just eating with abandon.
Yes.
Did you have concerns about your health as you were eating, or were you just totally diving into it?
Well, we spent a few dollars on inoculations.
Right.
Because there are lots of tropical diseases. And so we did all the precautionary stuff. We checked with the University of Washington Travel Service. We got our shots and all of that. Now, I happen to be a vegetarian.
Uh-huh.
So that's a little tricky. You'd think, oh, that's no problem in Vietnam. Well, everything in Vietnam, for example, has fish in it.
Oh, yeah.
Whether it's a fish sauce or something. And so I learned how to communicate with the waiters. I'd draw pictures, you know. And the final solution, we in the U.S. have come to like pho, which is basically a vegetable soup with some form of meat in it. And so now I learned as we traveled that they can make it with partridge eggs.
Oh, yeah.
So on the top of my pho are these six or eight little eggs this floating, and I take my chopsticks and I pick up one of those.
Very nice.
And I was taken care of. I often would say we had an Anthony Bourdain day.
Oh, yeah.
Because there is such variety in Bourdain, who I always loved his spirit as well. He basically said the best food in the world is street food.
Oh, yeah.
And particularly in Vietnam.
Oh,
so
yeah.
So when President Obama came and regularized relationships, they met in a cafe.
Yeah. You know, I was stuck in an airport. I think I was in Singapore or something like that. And I just had a delay. I was going to be sitting there for hours. And I thought, I don't want to eat airport food. And I remember I walked across the street and through the jungle, basically, to a village.
Yeah.
And then I got back into that street food, you know. And that was so much more enjoyable than sitting in the airport. And having
very
that.
Inexpensive. I
mean,
when we were in Phnom Penh in Cambodia, we would wander the streets in the evening and we would pick a place based on smell.
And then
there would be two tables, and grandma and daughter and child, and they had a little paper menu with pictures, and we pointed to the pictures, and then we'd ask how much it was, and it was usually $2.
Dave Ellingson is sharing his kayaking adventures in Southeast Asia with us today. He writes about his month along the Mekong River in the latest in his Paddle Pilgrim book series. Dave's also the author of children's books and Say What? A Fresh Look at Old Sayings. Dave tells us about viewing the infamous killing fields in Cambodia and what former American soldiers from the Vietnam War are doing in the region today. That's in just a minute. And in just a bit, the co-author of Gastro Obscura describes some of the most unusual food traditions from around the world that she's dug up. Plus, listeners share a few of their haiku souvenirs from their travels. Happy Easter from Travel with Rick Steves. Dave Ellingson's our guest on Travel with Rick Steves as the Paddle Pilgrim, and he tells us what he experienced and learned from a month of kayaking with his friends down the Mekong River in Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. So, Dave, this is the book that you had a little more complexities, let's say, that derailed your plans than the other books that we've talked about, the other adventures. And
yes.
And you talked about one of your themes was lingering with the lotus. What does that mean?
Well, and my other adventures, by and large, we had a number of miles we had to get to reach our goals. I've gotten older, and I'm not as strong as I used to be. So, and the conditions were not conducive to making that many miles. And fairly early, we sat down together, and I was the leader of the pack, but wise friends, and we decided we were just not going to be able to paddle as much. So we were on land a lot more. So we interacted with villagers and people. Then we'd be back on the river for a while, and then we got kicked off the river by the police in Vietnam because they thought we'd run into these illegal sand miners, people who are mining sand in the river. And so we were on and off. But the basic bottom line with that was we got to know the people and the country.
Okay.
Much better.
So you weren't as demanding on yourself of just getting down the river and battling the whole thing.
One of my friends on Facebook said, "You're smelling the roses." And I thought,
lingering with the lotus.
I haven't seen any
that's
roses.
Where that is. Okay. So
yes,
that's
I said, I think lingering with the lotus would be a better way of saying it.
That's your phrase?
Yes.
So instead of slow down and smell the roses, it's slow down and linger with the lotus.
Yes.
So now, you always highlight your river angels, the people that, and you know, when people are hiking the Appalachian Trail, they've got their trail angels
yes,
and so on.
Right, exactly.
In fact, that's, I think, what people call the people they meet on the venerable long-distance hikes is angels.
Right. Yeah.
So you have your river angels, and it's a big part of every one of your books. Tell us an example of a river angel that you met in Southeast Asia and how that kind of contributes to the takeaway you hope that your readers will enjoy after reading your book.
I'll describe really quickly. One was the hotel owner whose business was slow. So he just took us under wing and fed us and toured us around. Great hotel, beautiful, beautiful place. Secondly, there was a retired Lutheran pastor in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, who took us throughout the area, including the killing fields, which, of course, are the great genocide in which 2 million Cambodians died. And he would process in the cafes, the street cafes, at night, the beauty of the country and the terror and the tragedy of a whole country. And then when we were in Vietnam, Dr. Quang, who the author of the book I was telling you about, Brian Ehler, he did a chapter about the Mekong Environmental Forum, which is a community-based, college-educated thing where there are citizen scientists, and his students would go into the countryside and ask the citizens how climate change was affecting their village.
Uh-huh.
And so they come back, he writes articles, works with the government to change policies, and ecotourism is the number one way that they've been helping local communities along the river. So he took us and we toured 6 or 7 different sites where ecotourism was being used to raise the income of the people, share their native crafts. And so those were the 3 primary ones in the book.
You know, one thing that strikes me as I think about your adventure is how humanity, how people are able to survive wars and a generation later be together and be with each other. I think of it in former Yugoslavia. I think about it with Germany. I think about it with Japan. And I think you've experienced that when you think of older people who remember the Vietnam War,
right,
and anybody who knows how tragic that was and and what we did and what happened, all the tragedy of it. You go there now, younger people, they have no living memory of it. They don't really have a hang-up about it.
No.
They're just glad to see you.
And a lot of American soldiers, former soldiers, when we went through the War Remnants Museum, I was rubbing shoulders with guys my age, and I talked with several of them. Most of them had come back part of their healing. Some of them were going to the villages that they destroyed and are helping to rebuild the villages and heal the ache in their heart,
yes,
and to restore the country. And so it was very inspiring to meet those people and to see what they're doing now to help people in the country that they fought against.
That's a thing? American soldiers going back to the villages that they knew suffered under in the war and helping it get back on
track? The head of the Southeast Asian Studies Program at the University of Washington has become a friend, and he is a part of a group that goes back every couple of years to work on landmines.
Yes, that's a big deal, isn't it?
And people go for a couple of weeks and take that dangerous job on because they're removing landmines and unexploded ordnance all over the place.
In a lot of ways, the war carries on as long as those landmines are exploding.
And the worst what we saw was the Agent Orange genetic damage.
Yeah.
3 generations later, kids are still being born malformed with all sorts of limitations because of Agent Orange.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with Dave Ellingson. And Dave's a kayak adventurer, and he writes about his kayak experiences in his series of books called The Paddle Pilgrim. His latest book is featuring his trip on the Mekong River through Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Dave's website is paddle-pilgrim.com. Dave, of course, you had a lot of sightseeing highlights. I enjoyed you writing about wats, bots, and stupas. Tell us about wats, bots, and stupas.
Well, basically, those are the names that are local to the temples, the religious places. The Wat would be like Angkor Wat, which is the most famous in Cambodia.
That's supposed to be the world's largest religious ornament. And that'd be Buddhist, right?
It was originally Hindu because back in the 9th and 10th century, the Indian subcontinent was the biggest influence on Southeast Asia. So you'll find Hindu remains and art, and then more recently Buddhist. So you have a Wat, which is Buddhist, a Bat, which is Hindu, and a stupa is a little personal shrine. If you're driving along a road, you'll see out in the middle of a field a post, and this little temple on top of it. And that's a family stupa. And so if you're out plowing the ground or working in the rice paddy, you remember a great Grandpa Kwong.
Yeah.
And I think that's just a wonderful way of memorializing and remembering your ancient history.
Rather than collecting everybody in a cemetery, just kind of sprinkling it across the countryside.
Yeah, and you see them all over the place.
Oh, that's a beautiful thing. This was a month very well spent, it sounds like, for you.
It was. I learned a bunch.
Dave Ellingson, thank you. And I'm never going to forget this idea that we can linger with the lotus.
All right. Do it.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
You're welcome.
Dave has produced a 20-minute video presentation about his Mekong adventure called Down the Mekong, Journey of Discovery. It got a special mention at the 2024 Asia Southeast Short Film Festival. You can see it on YouTube and on Dave's website, paddle-pilgrim.com. One of our friends from Atlas Obscura joins us from her home studio now to take us on a mercifully brief culinary challenge with some of the world's quirkiest food traditions. Snacks you might be dared to sample that are relics from how our ancestors may have dined when there were no microwave ovens or refrigerators. Stinky cheese, horse meat, fried caterpillar, pig's ears. It's the cartilage. Hey, what's for dinner? That can mean so many different things all around the world. How adventurous are you when it comes to trying something new to eat or drink when you're traveling? The people at Atlas Obscura have compiled more than 500 of their most compelling culinary curiosities in their latest book. It's called Gastro Obscura. Cecily Wong helped to compile their food adventures guide, and she joins us now to explore some of the world's most original foods and the stories behind them. Specifically, today, I want to talk about foods that we have right now because yesterday we had no refrigeration. Cecily, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, now imagine if you had no refrigerator to keep your food good. Of course, that was the norm just a few generations ago. And much of the world's historic cuisines really were shaped by that simple challenge of keeping things from going rotten. Some famous and some notorious dishes will certainly be in your travel experience. So let's explore a few of these. And you've got a collection of 500 different food oddities in Gastro Obscura. Take me on a little tour about taste treats we have today because they were sort of developed when there was no refrigeration.
Yeah, pickling is one of the world's great culinary ingenuities, and there's tons across the globe. Every single continent has its own kind of pickling technique that has helped them preserve food without refrigeration. One of the wildest ones that is absolutely ingenious and probably not appetizing to us, but really amazing is that in Greenland, they make something called kiviak, where they, once a year, when it's auk season, people catch these tiny birds in these long-poled nets, and they shove hundreds of these tiny birds into a seal skin, and they sew it up, and they bury it under a rock for a year, and they let the birds ferment. And by the time it comes out, the whole bird is safe to eat. It's a celebrational food for them because it's just this kind of feat of preservation that gives them protein throughout the year. And I guess it tastes kind of like blue cheese. Very pungent, of course. It's a whole auk.
What is an auk? What do you mean by an auk?
It's a small bird.
If you can see my face right now, it's all crunched up. It sounds awful, but I guess if it's a matter of survival, imagine, you know, a long winter in Greenland, or along anything in Greenland, you've got to freeze your auk.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm sure it's an acquired taste. They don't recommend you do this yourself because if you choose the wrong bird, it can turn toxic. So it's a very specific process. You have to know what you're doing.
Okay, I will not do it myself. And
yeah.
Maybe when I go to Greenland, I don't know if you might find it. When I was in Iceland, I found some interesting foods on the menu that was kind of for tourists, but it comes out of their deep history. Did you venture to Iceland for your book?
We did. They have a very old and famous fermented shark that was invented by the Vikings while they were out on these long seafaring voyages. They were running into sharks and they wanted to eat them, but these sharks were full of poison. And so they needed to figure out how to remove the poison. And so they came up with this, again, ingenious way of pressing the shark and letting it leach the poison out and letting it ferment. So there are also fermented things that were kind of made by accident. For example, there's fermented teas in China. There's a long trading route that cuts across China called Tea Horse Road because they would transport these huge blocks of tea by horse for trading. And in the heat, they would start to ferment. And they noticed that the tea had this unique flavor and would keep for longer. And then they started doing it intentionally.
Cecily Wong's joining us from her home office in Portland, Oregon right now on Travel with Rick Steves. She's the co-author of Gastro Obscura, a food adventurer's guide. There's more at atlasobscura.com. So, Cecily, we're talking about, you know, pickling and accidental fermentation. What's another example of just some sort of a food specialty that we almost think is very basic now that has an interesting history?
Sauerkraut is exactly that. It is something that we love on hot dogs now, but it's got this fabled past as a way to treat scurvy for the Dutch Navy. You know, to fend off scurvy, you need vitamin C. And on these long voyages, they didn't have fresh fruits in order to give it. And so they discovered that by fermenting the cabbage, it would retain its vitamin C, and they all miraculously felt better. Lots of ships used sauerkraut, and they also used pine needles was another way of preventing scurvy, which also has a bunch of vitamin C. That was a Viking technique.
So people kind of just stumble around in different cultures and find things that work for them, accidental or a matter of survival, or sometimes they stumble onto something that I would imagine has hallucinogenic properties. What's some examples that you've come across in your research where people just stumble onto mood enhancers or just ways to get high to get through a dark winter?
Sure. There's people eating things and realizing that they are high and they did not intend to be. One great one is there's a honey in Turkey that people call mad honey. And there's a very specific rhododendron that grows high along the coast of the Black Sea. And it contains a toxin. So when bees eat the rhododendron, the honey that they make can be hallucinogenic. And so in small doses, Turkish people use this medicinally. But in larger doses, it can lead to massive hallucinations and paralysis even. There's a long history of using this honey for good and evil. One story that's amazing is that it was used against invading Roman soldiers in 67 BC. They were invading Anatolia, and the Anatolian soldiers knew their route. And so they placed this mad honeycomb along the way and knew that the soldiers would eat it. And they did. And they lost consciousness and they all fell along the route. And the Anatolian soldiers came back and finished them off.
That sounds like a scary fairy tale. I mean, because what soldier wouldn't love to find some honey on the roadside?
Yep, they knew they couldn't lose.
What are some other examples of hallucinogenic discoveries that different cultures have had?
There's one called Toloache, and it has a reputation across the world for doing different things. It depends on your dosage, which is a lot of these natural deliriants. A small dose in Mexico, they say that it's a love potion. If you give it to someone, they will fall in love with you. But if you give them the wrong dose, it can cause you to die. And so there's a very kind of thin line between romance and death. Hmm. It's another hallucinogenic that's used for visions and I'm sure recreationally as well.
Sounds like another weird fairy tale. One more hallucinogenic and then we'll wrap things up.
Yeah, so this one's not a hallucinogenic. This one's more of a stimulant. It's called guayusa, and it's a tree. And you use the leaves and you brew it into tea. And this is a tea that is used for dream interpretation. It's used traditionally by a tribe in Ecuador called the Quechua tribe. And it's part of their morning ritual where they brew the leaves, they drink the tea, and they discuss their dreams. It helps them plan their strategies and helps them understand what they're thinking. And the flip side of that is that people are now using this tea because it's a stimulant to facilitate lucid dreaming. And so it's said to kind of let you stay awake or at least,
Ooh. You
know,
you
kind
mean
of have
lucid dreaming, to like just to make sure your dreams are more fascinating.
More in that it gives you a little, it's said to give you a little control over your dreams. So if you're in a coffee shop, you'll be able to walk through the door by your own will.
Fascinating. Cecily Wong, thank you so much for joining us. And thanks for collecting all these food experiences in your latest book, Gastro Obscura.
Absolutely. It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Happy travels and bon appetit. Have you ever written a haiku to describe your travel experiences? Send us your original haiku from a link at ricksteves.com/radio. Here's what some of our Travel with Rick Steves listeners have penned to tell us about their travels.
Royal Rhodes of Gambier, Ohio, observed a spectacle at his feet at one of London's most popular sites. In Trafalgar Square, like a military band, pigeons still parade. Christine San Jose of Honesdale, Pennsylvania, was raised in Leicester, England. She sends us this memory with a bit of local dialect. My mum mashed our tea in her mum's old brown teapot. Best cuppa ever. While Diana Koupalos describes the fickle nature of springtime in Wyoming in this haiku. Two hats by the door, one straw, one fleece with ear flaps. Spring in Laramie. And Daniel Roberts from New York City had a surprise near Disney World in Orlando. Outside Space Mountain, I saw an actual mouse. The future is now.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced by Tim Tatton, Kaz Mora Hall, and Donna Bardsley at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. Affiliate relations are by Sheila Gerzoff. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Gretchen Strauch read our listener travel haiku. Send us your own original haiku about your travel impressions. We might even read it on the air one day. Details are in the radio pages of ricksteves.com.
Imagine a community of well-traveled friends who love sharing tips and comparing notes. That's our online community. It's called the Rick Steves Travel Forum. You can read trip reports, reviews, and share itinerary planning questions. Peruse the topics or post your own submissions. It's at ricksteves.com and you're invited.